Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Steve Potter, in for Don Marsh today. As I speak, plans are coming together for Circus Flora's new season right here in Grand Center, but it's what some people are calling the political circus that has the headlines right now, and that's the issue that will be addressed Thursday evening at the 5th Gateway Journalism Review Benefit. The public is invited to the Edward Jones headquarters in De Pere. On stage will be veteran political reporter David Yepsen, and on video from the nation's capital, broadcast journalist Ted Koppel, who joins us now, and welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Steve. Good to be with you.
It's an honor to have you here. You know, I don't think, Ted, that it matters so much what anyone's politics are. There are a lot of voters in this country that I guess are really taken aback by the tone of this year's presidential race. Some people call it a circus. Mr. Koppel, what do you think?
Oh, now it's Mr. Koppel. Well, sure. Why not? I mean, it certainly has the atmosphere of a three-ring event, and the tone of it is probably owes as much to entertainment as it does to the serious pursuit of politics. But I've been doing this for a very long time, and the first presidential campaign that I ever covered was Barry Goldwater's campaign back in 1964. Mm-hmm. And I still remember the tone at the Republican convention in the Cow Palace outside San Francisco in 1964. And there were people shaking their fist up into the rafters where the television anchors were sitting. The anti-media sentiment back then was almost as acrimonious as it is today. And when Nelson Rockefeller, who sort of represented the moderate wing of the Republican Party, when he got up to speak, he could barely be heard because he was being booed so loudly. So it's not the first time that there has been acrimony in the political process. I doubt that it's ever been, at least in recent years, by which I mean in the last 50 or so, I don't think it's ever been at a lower level of, what's the correct word for it, politesse. You know, it's just about as nasty as it's been in the last 50 years.
But we need a little drama in politics, don't we?
Well, if we didn't love it so much, and by we, I suppose I have to point the finger first of all at us in the media, if we didn't seize on it as avidly as we do, I don't think it would have become as big an issue this time around. But clearly, of all the candidates, Donald Trump has learned how to turn the media's sense of drama and its appetite for drama to his own best advantage, and he has done it brilliantly.
Well, do you think Donald Trump is being covered too much? I mean, after all, the journalists are reporting things that he's saying.
Yes, I think he's being covered too much. I mean, at this stage, it's not a question of his being covered too much because he's one of only three Republican candidates still standing, and John Kasich has only won one primary. So basically, at the moment at least, it's between Trump and Ted Cruz. You have to cover both of them at this point. They're the likeliest ones to get the nomination, although obviously it's not a foregone conclusion that either one of them will. But earlier on in the campaign, 2 months ago, 3 months ago, did the media give Donald Trump more attention than he deserved? Absolutely. Absolutely. And we did it because he has the showman's ability to put, behinds in the seats, and he brought more television eyeballs to the screen. And the fact of the matter is that it didn't take people in the network or cable news divisions long to realize that when Donald Trump was on the stage, more people were watching the debates than had ever watched them in recent years. So, we got what we deserved. Whether the American public deserved it is another question.
Well, so the showbiz quotient has been high.
The showbiz quotient has been, I think, dominant.
And who suffers the most from that?
Well, I think democracy suffers, quite frankly. I think the republic suffers. I hope I can get the quote correct, but it was Thomas Jefferson who spoke about if a nation expects that it can have both ignorance and freedom in a civil society, and it expects what never was and never will be. And at the moment, we're putting a very heavy emphasis on ignorance. Most of the communication that seems to be having the greatest effect, ironically, is through social media. Donald Trump is absolutely brilliant at using Twitter and Facebook. He claims to have, I think, 6 million Twitter followers and 6 or 7 million Facebook followers. And it provides an illusion of intimacy. There is the sense among those 10 or 11 million people that they are hearing directly from the candidate. And that has had an enormous impact. But as I say, it's an illusion of intimacy. It's not real intimacy. And as for substance, there has been very little substance, at least on the Republican side. The Democrats, to their credit, and in large measure because they've been down to two candidates for quite a while now, have been engaging in a much more substantive debate. But that's a function of how many people were on that stage to begin with. I think it's practically impossible to have an intelligent debate among, what was it at one point, 17 people?
Right.
You didn't have 17 on stage at all times, but you had, because you always had the B team having an earlier debate and then the A team. But even when you have 10 people up there, you cannot expect much substance if each person is limited to only a minute of time to be able to respond to some of the most difficult issues of our time.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a little earlier the Goldwater campaign, and I barely remember that one. I do remember it, but I remember when I was a little bit older than that, say when George Wallace won, that was very contentious. Have there ever been any, and you've been covering elections since sometime in the 60s, so do you ever remember an election that was, by today's standards, dull?
Do I ever remember an election that was dull?
Yeah, that didn't have a wild card like this in it?
Well, I'm trying to think. The original 1960 campaign between Nixon and Kennedy did not. The campaign between Goldwater and Johnson did not. The campaign ultimately between Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter did not. I mean, many of them haven't.
I'm wondering if you were like a lot of other people I know when this campaign season started and Donald Trump started to win some primaries and garner attention. Everything I heard was everyone expected it just to, you know, run out of steam the next time around, and it never did. Did you ever expect it to go this far?
No. Absolutely not. And I didn't expect it, not because I thought it would run out of steam. I thought it would implode. I mean, if you have a presidential candidate who is insulting women, insulting Hispanics, insulting a handicapped reporter for the New York Times, insulting a war hero like John McCain, you would think that any one of those would be enough to cause the campaign to implode. But what Donald Trump clearly recognized, and frankly what Bernie Sanders has recognized on the Democratic side, is that there are millions of people in this country today who simply do not accept any authority figures as being above reproach. Quite the contrary, in fact. Authority figures, whether they be in politics or in the media, You know, there was a time, not so many years ago, at least it seems to me, when you had a television journalist, Walter Cronkite, who was seen as the most admired man in the country and the most trusted man in the country. That seems almost quaint today. You cannot imagine anyone in the media being perceived as the most trusted man or woman in the country anymore, because the nation has been so sharply divided by the ideological divergence of the media, where you have an MSNBC on the left and a Fox on the right, you know, the Rush Limbaughs out there, who clearly push everything through the prism of their particular ideology, so that you have people now tuning in not to get what they perceive to be an objective view of events in the world, but who are deliberately picking something that has an ideological slant or tilt with which they can sympathize. That doesn't lend itself to a lot of compromise or understanding in the political process. And I think it's been terribly damaging to the political process. Mr. Trump clearly recognized, as has Bernie Sanders, that by appealing to the dissatisfaction of a large number of people who have been alienated from the process, he was going to be able to do very well. Now, whether that translates from the primary or caucus season to a general campaign remains to be seen. I doubt it. I don't think so. But as I say, I've been wrong since last summer. There's no reason to believe that I've suddenly been inspired with greater knowledge than I had before.
Well, we'll see. You mentioned, Ted, about the media not being respected and trusted by the public. How does that make you feel, someone that has worked their whole life in this profession at a time when they were respected? You mentioned Walter Cronkite, and there are a number of others. So that was your goal, and that's how you felt your entire career things should be, and now we've come to this. I mean, how does that make you feel personally?
Well, it makes me feel saddened for the business as a whole, because when I got into the business, my heroes were people like Ed Morrow and Howard K. Smith and Eric Severide. They were people who, as I did when I got into the business, regarded journalism as a calling, I don't want to exaggerate, but almost a mission. And the mission was to give people the information that they needed to have in order to be an informed electorate. More and more over the past 20 years, what has happened is that the fragmentation of media because of the technological advances, and the fragmentation of media because of the discovery that by tilting in one ideological direction or another, you can gain a lot of supporters and a lot of people who watch, and this is largely the brainchild of Rupert Murdoch, who created Fox News, and realized that there was a great hunger out there among conservatives in this country for what they perceive to be a more objective take on the news. There has always been a feeling that reporters, by and large, tend to tilt a little bit more to the left than to the right. And so when Rupert Murdoch created Fox News, he was obviously responding to a huge public appetite out there. And when Fox News started making an enormous amount of money, as it did, then the folks who owned MSNBC, the people at NBC, said to themselves, well, we can do the same thing he did. We'll just appeal to the left instead of to the right. And that's what they have done with MSNBC. And to a lesser degree than with Fox, it has also been a commercial success. So more and more over the course of the past 20 years, in part because there are far more competitors out there than there ever were back in the days of only three networks. Now you have untold cable stations, satellite stations, and, of course, the Internet, which has thousands upon thousands of outlets. That makes the commercial competitiveness greater than it's ever been before. And so more and more these days, the public is getting what broadcasters and the owners of cable networks believe they want to see and want to hear, rather than what they need to hear.
The Gateway Journalism Review benefit will be Thursday, featuring Ted Koppel and David Yepsen. It will be moderated by journalist William Freivogel. Now, the audience will be asking questions, and our audience has a chance to do that right now. If you have a question or a comment you'd like to bounce off Ted Koppel, give us a call at 314-382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can email us at STL, that's talk at stlpublicradio.org, talk at stlpublicradio.org. You can also tweet us at STL on air. We'll be back in just a minute. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. This is St. Louis on the Air. I'm Steve Potter, and we're talking to Ted Koppel today. He's going to be part of the 5th Gateway Journalism Review benefit, which is coming up Thursday, but he is with us today. And, Ted, you mentioned Fox News before we went to the break, and you were a guest on Bill O'Reilly's Fox program, I guess it was a few weeks ago, and he asked you how you would interview Trump, and you made an interesting point about that being irrelevant, and you said some other things.
Well, I didn't say it was irrelevant. I said that Mr. Trump is particularly good at ignoring questions he doesn't want to answer and giving answers to questions that were never asked. And he's also particularly good at remaining unrestricted by any adherence to facts. So, you know, it's very tough to do a live interview with someone who's not playing by the customary rules of an interview. You know, I get to ask a question, you get to answer it. I don't know what else it is you're referring to, but I mentioned to Bill at the time that I thought the better way of dealing with all the candidates, but especially with Mr. Trump, is to do a piece of reporting that gives the viewing public or the listening public a sense of what the facts are, and that the interview. I mean, that's what we used to do on the old Nightline program. We'd usually begin the program with a 5 or 6 minute piece laying out the facts, and then the guests would come on, and it tended to focus the conversation a little better. Whether that would have worked with Donald Trump in his role as a presidential candidate, maybe not, but I think it might have been a little bit more helpful.
We're going to go to the phones here in just a second at 382-8255, 382-TALK. But just briefly, let me play devil's advocate. We talk about what Trump is doing, but how much responsibility should the media and journalists have for allowing it to happen or not perhaps handling it a different way?
Well, I think there's a great deal of responsibility. But what I was saying before, Steve, is that we live and operate in an age now where news programs, by and large, tend to focus more on what news producers perceive the public wants to hear about rather than what it needs to hear about. And so if you watch, for example, the three network news programs, every evening, you will see almost every day an extraordinary focus on weather. Why? I mean, is weather always the most important news story of the day? Probably not. But they have discovered from surveys that have been done that the public has a great appetite for weather stories. you will also see, almost inevitably, some unbearably cute piece of video on what is, after all, meant to be a national news program. They don't have that much time for real news, and Lord knows the Internet, I think, takes ample care of cute little kittens. But they still do it, and they do it precisely because of what I mentioned before. Competition is much sharper, much more severe today than it was 20 years ago, and they're just trying to get an audience.
Let's go to the phone. Paul is calling from St. Louis with a comment about the campaigns. Hi, Paul. You're on the air with Ted Koppel. Go ahead.
Hello, all. And Mr. Koppel, thanks for coming to St. Louis. Question I have is, you mentioned the left-wing media and the right-wing media. I think that's all true. I try to take a far-reaching breadth of media to get my news, but that's all private enterprise. You know, I expect that, and I can turn off the radio. I can do as I please. But with National Public Radio and St. Louis Public Radio, that's taxpayer-funded. And my concern about NPR is, because it's taxpayer-funded, I would think the mandatory gotta-have would be balance. And yet, when I look at the NPR shows, without exception, every one of them is hosted by a left-leaning or a progressive host that colors the content and tone of the show. So my question is, where is the George Will or the Cato Institute to offset a John Hockenberry or a Diane Rehm? And I just don't see that on NPR. And I think NPR misses its opportunity to strike a true balance for taxpayers that are funding it.
Thank you, Paul.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of points, Paul. Number one, as I'm sure you know, it's not entirely taxpayer-funded. In fact, I think the larger part of the pie is actually paid for with those god-awful fundraising campaigns that NPR has to run, what is it, Steve, twice a year, or is it more? It seems as though it's almost every other month. But a lot of it comes from listener donations. In terms of your perception that NPR is more progressive or liberal-leaning than conservative or right-wing-leaning, I'd have to agree with you. I think that's so. All in all, though, and I am an avid listener to NPR, I must tell you that in the overall scheme of things today, I think if you had to make a choice among listening to any one of the three commercial networks to get a sense, an accurate sense, a factual sense of what is going on in the world today, if your choice were among the three commercial television networks or NPR, I'd pick NPR in a heartbeat.
We have Mike calling from The Hill, and he seems to see a reality show in this. Mike, what are your thoughts?
Hi, Ted. Yeah, I think since the Internet, since the last 15 years, the world has really changed, and we have not quite gotten hold of it yet. And the television, of course, has devolved into a reality show. That's about all they have anymore. And NPR, I would have to agree with you. NPR is the best information, because it takes more time. And even if there is a slight bent somewhere, you get a chance to reiterate that. But I think the Internet is a problem we're going to have to figure out, because right now everybody's scrambling to be somewhere. And people are self-identifying in little locations and creating these little hotspots of radicalism. And until we figure out how to filter all that, we're going to have some craziness for a while.
Yeah, I agree with everything you've said except for the last three words when you say for a while. I think we're sort of doomed to have this because of the Internet. What you have now is the capacity for everyone out there to find an echo chamber for his or her own opinions. And for reasons that I've never quite understood, it appears that a great many people out there would rather hear someone who agrees with them than someone who's actually giving them good, objective information, even though they may disagree with some of that. We're doomed, I think, now. We live in a culture in which there is probably more information floating around than ever in the history of mankind, and less wisdom, less ability to process that information in an objective fashion. And that's terribly, terribly dangerous to a system like ours, which in the final analysis does depend on an informed electorate.
Let me share a couple of emails that we've gotten with you. Kelly says that these people always had the echo chambers. They just weren't visible. The Internet makes them visible. So that's one thought.
Well, I have no way of knowing what generation Kelly comes from, but I must tell you that 50 years ago in this country, you only had three networks, and they strove mightily to be as middle of the road, as objective as they could be. And one of the great differences that existed 50 years ago is that the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, had teeth. And there was a need, a requirement, in fact, that people who had licenses to broadcast, whether that was the networks or individual radio or television stations, were obliged to operate, and this is the exact phrasing, in the public interest, convenience, and necessity. And that meant, in order for the government's willingness to let these radio stations, television stations, and networks make tons of money by putting out light comedy or adventure programs, they had an obligation at the same time to provide news. And people could lose their licenses, could be suspended, they could be revoked. That just doesn't happen anymore. I think things have changed. I think things are vastly different today, Kelly, than they were 50 years ago.
Yeah, and you make the point of when there were only three networks, and I have to admit, I'm old enough. I remember when those three networks went off the air at 11 or 12.
Sure, yeah. Sure. Yeah.
So it's a totally different world. Let's go back to the phones. John's calling from Overland. You're on the air with Ted Koppel. John, go ahead.
By the way, that was very quick. Thank you. I could make my comment in maybe 45 seconds at the list. The Pew Research Center has listed the five things between the wealth gap between black and whites that are not personal responsibility and not whether someone's married or not. And this is not being reported at all or almost not at all on radio and TV. Here's the five things that make blacks about 1,600 times, 1,600%, which is 16 times, poorer per household. Number one is the slavery and the residual effects. Number two is Jim Crow and the residual effects. A big one is number three, the racist application of the GI Bill and the residual effects. And number four is white flight. Number five is the racist banking and lending practices. And the right-wingers will tell you 50 years of bad Democratic policy is oppressed blacks. So according to left wing and right wing and Pew Research Center, for 240 years, there's been a wealth gap that is worse than the wealth gap any time under apartheid in South Africa. This is just household wealth. And it's not, and I'm sure Ted Koppel is familiar with this gap, maybe not that it's 16 times, but not because of a choice or being married. It's all these things I listed that have been made blacks unable to pass on wealth from generation to generation.
Got your point, John. Thank you.
Yeah, I can't take serious issue with anything that the caller said, except, and I've had some experience in South Africa, I do believe things were a lot worse under apartheid in South Africa than even I certainly won't say in the worst days of slavery or Jim Crow, but if we're talking about the last 40 or 50 years in this country, I don't think you can compare the conditions here in the United States unfavorably with apartheid in South Africa.
Ted, you had a book that came out last year called Lights Out, in which you say that a cyber attack on America's power grid is not a possibility, that it's likely. And Steve has emailed a question about that. He said he's read that, Lights Out. And he said, after your mention of it, 1 second after, both books deal with the threat of an attack on the grid. Have you seen any changes in the last few months that give you hope that the government is working to prevent such an occurrence?
All I can tell you is I know that some states have actually been influenced by the book and are now looking at making some local adjustments. I've been asked to testify before one Senate committee in about another, I guess it'll be about another 3 or 4 weeks. And I know that there is another congressional committee that is holding hearings. So do I know that anything has changed for the better yet? No. Do I see signs of a little bit of motion? Yes.
All right. We have time for one more call. Let's go over to Belleville and Josh. Hi, Josh. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to ask Ted if he could talk a little more about when and why he thinks reporters have decided that it's not their job to confront our leaders with facts. Like Donald Trump could basically say, you know, the sky is red, and then instead of the reporters saying, actually, Mr. Trump, the sky is blue, they'll just put a breaking news banner at the bottom of the screen and say, oh, Donald Trump says the sky is red. What do you think about this?
Yeah, I think, I mean, look, I'm as critical of my present-day colleagues as anybody out there, but I think you're exaggerating just a wee bit. There have been a lot of reporters out there who have tried to confront Mr. Trump with facts that are contrary to what he is saying. He is particularly good at just bulldozing his way right through that. It's a fact of life that he is very good at television. He is a wonderful television performer. He really is. And I don't think that's going to translate to a general campaign, if indeed he does get the nomination. But he has certainly used it. I think even he must be surprised at how well he has succeeded. But I don't think it's entirely fair to suggest that reporters have not been asking him the tough questions. I think they have.
Ted, do you dare to make a prediction?
I should probably allow wisdom to be the better part of discretion. No, I don't dare make a prediction because I'm just going to be wrong anyway.
I thought I might get you there, though. The Fifth Gateway Journalism Review benefit featuring Ted Koppel and David Yepsen is Thursday, beginning at 6 p.m. at the Edward Jones headquarters in De Pere. If you want more information about that, be sure and go to our website, stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. As I understand, you do need tickets, but you don't need to get them in advance. You can get those at the door. So from here, Ted, a couple of days, you're out of the country and you're going to Armenia.
I am. I'm heading off to a humanitarian conference. I mean, you want to talk about huge events that don't get a whole lot of attention. This is the 101st anniversary of what came to be known as the Armenian Genocide. Somewhere between 1 and 1.5 million Armenians were killed in 1915. It's still a controversial issue to this day because it was the Turkish government that carried out most of the killings, and it is still something that they deny to this day.
Mm-hmm. Well, have a safe journey, and we look forward to, of course, hearing from you again on Thursday at the event in St. Louis. Ted Koppel, thank you for your body of work and for what you've done and for your time today.
Thank you, Steve. I enjoyed it.
Ted Koppel. This is St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.